All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies. This is a very special edition of Torah Studies. So our Torah Studies class tonight, is all about the holiday of Hanukkah. And the class is entitled Essential Oils, and what we're going to do tonight is explore the Kabbalah of oil. What is the deeper secret of oil? What does oil signify? What does it mean for us? And what lessons can we learn from this holiday that we can apply immediately to our lives today? So what we're going to do in this class is we're going to go through. So the class exists on multiple levels, in multiple stages. The first part of the class is going to be exploring the story of Hanukkah from four different sources. Then we're going to look at some of the traditions of Hanukkah that we're familiar with. Then we're going to ask questions on the traditions that we're familiar with. And then we're going to get to an exposition, a deeper exposition on the concept of oil and bring it all together. So let's begin by telling the story of Hanukkah the way it first appears in Jewish literature. You should know, the story of Hanukkah, Hanukkah is a rabbinic holiday. In other words, if you open up the Torah, you're not going to find Hanukkah in the Torah. And there's a very simple reason why. Why? Because it happened once they closed the book. Once they finished writing the book, it's like, oh, now Hanukkah happened. Mm-hmm. It happens 100 centuries later, after Moses is long passed, and after Joshua is long passed, and after King David has long passed, and after King Solomon is long passed, and after even the first temple had already been destroyed. So it was in the second temple era, that is when the story of Hanukkah occurs. The story of Hanukkah, does not have a formal Megillah that we use. You know, we use Megillat Esther, the book of Esther. We recount the story that happened in the times of Ahasuerus and Mordechai and Esther, etc. There is no formal text that we read on Hanukkah that recounts the story. There's no tractate in the Talmud that's dedicated to Hanukkah. There's a tractate for Pesach, it's called Pesachim. There's a tractate for Shabbat, it's called Shabbat. There's a tractate for Purim, it's called Megillah. There's a tractate for Rosh Hashanah, it's called Rosh Hashanah. There's a tractate for Yom Kippur, it's called Yoma. There's a tractate for Sukkot, it's called Sukkah. All the holidays have a tractate. Shavuot doesn't have a tractate because Shavuot is about the Torah and the whole thing is Torah. So it doesn't have its own dedicated tractate. The only holiday that doesn't have a tractate is the holiday of Hanukkah. In tractate Shabbat, in the context of talking about Shabbat candles and lighting Shabbat candles, interjected somewhere on page 21 of tractate Shabbat, you have a mention about the holiday of Hanukkah. So we're going to read text one. Ray's going to get us started, please. Text one is the first, is the oldest source that we have. Again, there's a Megillah. There is a Megillah that was written by some. We don't, it wasn't canonized ever as like one of the formal Jewish books. But the first formal studied source that we have is text one from the Talmud where it talks about the Hanukkah holiday. Please begin.
What is Hanukkah? The rabbis have taught on the 25th of Kislev, there are 8 days of Hanukkah during which we do not eulogize nor fast.
In other words, that's a way of saying that it's a day of holiday, a day of days of joy in which we don't overtly demonstrate anything of sadness or self-affliction, so no eulogizing, no fasting. Continue.
When the Greeks entered the sanctuary, they contaminated all of the oil in the sanctuary, and when the house of Hasmoneans overcame and defeated them, they searched and only found one flask of oil that was placed with the seal of the high priest. There was only enough to light for one day. A miracle occurred, and it remained lit for 8 days.
One more line, top of 175.
The following year, they established a holiday with Hallel and Thanksgiving.
All right, so here we have the quick story. The Greeks entered the sanctuary, defiled the oils. The Jews got it back. They looked for oil. They only found one flask. It lasted for 8 days. and then they established a holiday. Straightforward? Yes? It's a story we all know and love? Good. Maimonides' Rambam adds a lot of critical detail. Rambam adds details about what it is that the Greeks did. Notice the Talmud kind of glosses over it. The Talmud says, well, when the Greeks entered the sanctuary, why? Was it a Torah? Was it like Greek day in the temple? Was it like, you know, Greek salad and Greek, like, what was going on?
Open house.
Open house? And they come in and they broke everything, huh?
Baklava,
like, what was going on?
Thanks to Hashem, for they defeated the Syrian Greeks in the battle.
Right, but I'm saying, what were the Greeks? Look at the third paragraph over there. When the Greeks entered the sanctuary, they contaminated all the oils. Is it like, you know, like the Torah came in and they busted up the place and like, hey, you're never invited back. Obviously, it's a little bit more insidious than that. It's a little bit more devious. So text number two, Rambam fills in some details that the Talmud glosses over. Jillian, please read text two from Rambam, his Laws of Chanukah, Hilchot Chanukah, page 175.
In the era of the Second Temple, the Greek kingdom issued decrees against the Jewish people, attempting to nullify their faith and refusing to allow them to observe the Torah and its commandments. They extended their hands against their property and their daughters. They entered the sanctuary, wrought havoc within, and made the sanctuaries impure.
Continue 176, please.
The Jews suffered great difficulties from them, for they oppressed them greatly, until the God of our ancestors had mercy upon them, delivered them from their hand, and saved them. The sons of the Hasmoneans, the high priests, overcame and then slew them and saved the Jews from their hand. They appointed a king from the priests, and sovereignty returned to Israel for more than 200 years until the destruction of the Second Temple. When the Jews overcame their enemies and destroyed them, they entered the sanctuary. This was on the 25th of Kislev. They could not find any pure oil in the sanctuary, with the exception of a single cruse. It contained enough oil to burn for merely one day. They lit the arrangement of lights from it for 8 days until they could crush olives and produce pure oil.
So the last part of it, we know, the last part of it about the Jews coming in and finding only one flask or cruse of oil and it lasting nonetheless for 8 days. That we already had in the Talmud. What Rambam fills in, what Maimonides fills in is the first piece of it. What were the Greeks doing? So Rambam says, what did they do? They attempted to nullify their faith. They refused to allow them to observe Torah and the mitzvot. They extended their hands against their property and their daughters, entered their sanctuary, wrought havoc, etc. So all of this stuff was going on. And then it talks about the victory, and there's a little bit more elaboration on the victory. The point is, now we have a little bit of a more well-rounded picture of what it is that actually went down before the victory and before the miracle of the oil. Text number three, this is our third source. Remember, we have four sources to piece the story together. Text three is from Josephus. Josephus was an ancient, historian. He lived, you see there in his little bio on the side over there, he lived around the year 37 to the year 100 of the Common Era. Famously, he was a Jewish guy who, at the time of the destruction of the temple, kind of went over to the Roman side, and he became valuable to the Romans, and they afforded him a lot of honor because he wrote scholarly texts for them, mainly the history of the Jews. So he was the official historian, Jewish historian, that became Roman or whatever, you know, took on a Roman name, Josephus. Trust me, at his bris milah, at his Brit circumcision, they didn't call him Josephus. It wasn't a thing.
Yosef.
It's probably Yosef, exactly, right? So Yosef ben Matisyo HaKohen. Oh, look at that. His father was Matisyo, not the singer, by the way. Maybe he was also a singer, but I don't know. So here's the point. Josephus is also a fantastic source of history. So again, the first legitimate Jewish halachic legal source is the Talmud, then Rambam, but now we go back to Josephus, who again, although not a halachic source, is still an ancient source with Jewish roots, and this will be beneficial for us as well. Text 3, Karen, please read.
Antiochus forced the Jews to cast aside the service of their God and instead to serve the gods that he believed in, to erect temples for them in each city and town, and to build altars and sacrifice swine on them each day. He also decreed that they were to no longer circumcise their sons. Thus they were persecuted daily, suffering terrible punishment until they expired. Any Torah scroll or holy book that was found was desecrated. Those in whose possession it was found were killed in a disgraceful manner.
So Josephus adds some more details. He talks about setting up altars of idolatry in every city. He talks about daily sacrifices of swine on these false, on these foreign altars to these foreign gods. He talks about the prohibition against brit milah, circumcision. Talks about the prohibition against having or possessing or studying Torah. So here we have more details about the spiritual persecution, the Jewish persecution that occurs before everything gets better, before the Jews reclaim the temple and find the oil. Remember, the Talmud glosses over it. The Talmud just says, when the Greeks entered the temple, they defied all that, and then we got it back, and then we lit it, and it was a miracle in the lighting. How bad did it get with the Greeks? We don't know from the Talmud. But we have other sources. It was very, very bad. Very difficult time, spiritually, Jewishly, etc. Make sense so far? Yes? Okay. Text number 4. This will be our final text from a historical perspective. Text 4 comes from our prayers. This is the liturgy, prayer liturgy, that was canonized a long time ago, many, many, many centuries ago, 2,000 years ago, basically, at the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, and they inserted, so this prayer harkens back many, many centuries, and it talks about, that's hilarious, in the bio, I don't usually read the bio, but in the bio of 177 about the Siddur, it says it was first published in New York in 1945. Trust me, the Siddur was not first published in 1945. The Chabad version of the Siddur from which this is lifted, although it appears identically in other prayer books, was printed first in 1945. But trust me, this was not first penned in 45 of 19. That didn't happen. All right, here we have from the prayers in the Amida. So, the typical daily prayers are centered around the Amida. The Amida is the highlight of the prayers. Three prayers a day, three Amidot prayers. The weekday prayer is comprised of three opening standard opening blessings that are always said, the three standard closing blessings, and a chunk of blessings in the middle that contain personal requests for things like wisdom, forgiveness, health, parnasa, livelihood, etc. All the basic things, redemption, Mashiach, Israel, etc. All the basic things that we need. So that's your typical Amida blessing, three times a day, morning, afternoon, and evening, night. Fine. When it comes to Shabbat, we replace the middle. Instead of asking for what we need, we talk about the theme of the day. We talk about Shabbat and the gift that Shabbat is. If it's a holiday, we talk about the holiday and what the holiday themes are. So we supplant, we basically swap out the middle for the theme of the day. If it's not a major holiday, if it's just like a minor holiday, like a Rosh Chodesh, first day of the month, or like, which reminds me, Rosh Chodesh Society for the Women this Monday night, Monday evening, 7:30, join us. My wife is teaching. It's a great class. Okay, now that our PSA, public service announcement, is over. So on Rosh Chodesh, on the rabbinic holidays like Purim and Chanukah, and like Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days of the major holidays, on those days we recite a standard Amida prayer. We just add a prayer, one paragraph. We insert one paragraph that's about the Yalaviyava, that's about the holiday. When it comes to Chanukah and Purim, that's for Rosh Chodesh and the intermediate days of the holidays. When it comes to the rabbinic holidays, Purim and Chanukah, instead of adding the Yala Viyobo paragraph, we add another paragraph, which is called Valanisim, which speaks about the miracles. And this excerpt, this is a long introduction for an excerpt, this is explaining the context of text number 4. Text number 4 comes from that prayer that is inserted in the Amida on Chanukah. All three Amidot per day for the 8 days of Chanukah, this paragraph, which this excerpt of this, which is this paragraph, these paragraphs, this prayer is recited, And it's also recited in the grace after meals on these days. So let's take a read. David.
And we thank you for the miracles, for the redemption, for the mighty deeds, for the saving acts, and for the wonders which you have wrought for our ancestors in those days at this time. In the days of Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, the high priest, the Hasmonean, and his sons, when the wicked Hellenic government rose up against your people, Israel, to make them forget your Torah and violate the decrees of your will. But you, in your abounding mercies, stood by them in the time of their distress. You waged their battles, defended their rights, and avenged the wrong done to them. You delivered the mighty into the hands of the weak, the many into the hands of the few, the impure into the hands of the pure, the wicked into the hands of the righteous, and the wanton sinners into the hands of those who occupy themselves with your Torah. You made a great and holy name for yourself in your world, and you effected a great deliverance and redemption for your people, Israel, to this very day. Then your children entered the shrine of your house, cleansed your temple, purified your sanctuary, kindled the lights in your holy courtyards, and instituted these 8 days of Hanukkah to give thanks and praise to your great name.
Thank you. Okay, so from these four texts, hopefully a nice, clear picture, maybe a picture that you already know and you've heard a million times, but it's good to go back to the sources. So a clear picture of Hanukkah should emerge. So if I ask you, based on all of this, what happened on Hanukkah? What happened? We got the temple back, and what else?
And we found
one thing of oil that lasted for
8 days.
So how many miracles happened, generally speaking?
Two.
One is?
The battle.
The battle, right? The military victory of the many in the hands of the few. No, that makes, yeah, many hands of the few, the many in the hands of the weak. So I think so, that right? Et cetera. And, okay, and basically overthrowing that religious persecution oppression that was happening. So that's one miracle that happens. Second miracle that happens is
oil.
The oil, lasting for 8 days. Let's rank mentions. You'll see what I mean by that. Rank mentions, what does that mean? Okay, in text one from the Talmud, do we mention the military victory? What's mentioned in text one, the military victory or the oil?
Oil.
The oil is played up. Okay, text number two, what's played up, Maimonides? The battle. Okay, text three. Well, text three is about the persecution. Okay, that's about like the, yeah, how bad that was. And text four, which is from the prayers, what do we play up? Also?
It's really
more about the battle, right? Look how glossed over the oil piece of it. It's the last paragraph. Then your children entered the shrine of your house, cleansed your temple, purified your sanctuary, kindled the lights. It doesn't even talk about the miracle of finding the oil and it lasted for 8 days. It doesn't mention any of that. It just says we lit it for 8 nights. Why eight? Look somewhere else to figure that out. But the Siddur just kind of glosses over that. It really plays up the military piece of it. Okay, fine, good. So this is how Hanukkah is discussed in the sources. One thing to note, I'm not asking it in the form of a question. Sorry, Alex Trebek. However, what I am saying, I'm just pointing out the fact that we see, in a sense, some different ways of explaining the holiday of Hanukkah. Text number five takes us to how we observe the holiday. What do we do to observe Hanukkah? And of course, we all know this, but let's read it inside. This again comes from Rambam, Mishneh Torah. These are the laws of Hanukkah. Sandrine, please read text five.
Accordingly, the sages of that generation ordained that these 8 days, which begin from the 25th of Kislev, should be commemorated as days of happiness and praise of God. Candles should be lit in the evening at the entrance to the houses on each and every one of his 8 nights to publicize and reveal the miracle. These days are called Hanukkah.
I was wondering what Hanukkah meant, but now, boom, these days are called Hanukkah. Right, so Rambam says, what is Hanukkah? How do we observe Hanukkah? From the 25th day of Kislev, which began Sunday night, this past Sunday night, until for 8 days, right? So what do? We light candles in the evening. Where? At the entrance of the house. Why? By the entrance of the house? Publicize the miracle. Which, by the way, this is unique to Hanukkah. Unique to Hanukkah is this notion of the observance of the holiday being done in a way that publicizes it to others. There's no mitzvah, for example, Pesach. make sure to eat your matzah outside and leave big crumbs so that everyone knows that you ate the crunchy matzah. No, never happened. No one ever said that you should be so inebriated on Purim that you should end up falling asleep in the neighbor's bushes and the sprinkler wakes you up in the morning, and that way you publicize the idea of Purim. Although,
so why did you do it?
Although it certainly happened. I'm not speaking from experience. However, and when it comes to, for example, Yom Kippur, it doesn't say that you should fast to the point where, I don't know, I can't come up with something funny on that one. Yeah.
And doesn't it say in Tractate Shabbat, there's actually, isn't there a mention in Tractate Shabbat about the importance of publicizing?
Yeah.
And even putting it above, like if you have a little bit of money and you don't have enough money, then, and you have to choose between Kiddush, wine for Kiddush, or oil for your Hanukkah to light the Hanukkah lights, that you should get the oil for your Hanukkah lights.
Yeah, there's something about Hanukkah that's really about spreading the light, publicizing the miracle, which is why, one of the reasons why, the Rebbe started the campaign to do public menorah lightings. We just had one a few minutes ago, an hour ago or so, in Pond City Market right down the street. And it's something that is so innate to the Hanukkah observance itself. It's all about spreading the light and publicizing the miracle. So it's such a beautiful theme that's really embedded in this. Look, the Rebbe was all about taking every element of Judaism to the streets. Put on tefillin in the street, blow the shofar in the streets, you know, whatever it is. If somebody didn't hear it, so that's it. Go to the Beltline and blow the shofar, and, you know, somebody that needs to hear it. But Hanukkah, it's like part and parcel of it itself. I just thought I'd mention it in text 5. So when it comes to the observance of the holiday, this is what I want to point out. When it comes to the observance of the holiday, which element of the miracle or the experience of the story of Hanukkah, which element do we commemorate? Remember, there are two elements. There's the military victory piece of it, and the finding of the oil, one flask that lasts for 8 days. Which piece of the Hanukkah story do we celebrate? Only the oil. And we totally gloss over the military piece of it, the military victory of the many in the hands of the few and the mighty in the hands of the weak. All of that, that entire miracle is relegated to a mention in our prayers, but nothing tangible that we do. We don't like have, I don't know what we would actually do to commemorate that, but there's nothing symbolic. There's nothing that symbolizes that element. It seems to be a big piece of it. And yet, we're commemorating what seems to be just what I would call maybe a side miracle. In other words, let's take a step back. What was the big simcha? What was the big joy by Hanukkah?
The battle.
We got back to the temple. They kicked us out of our own temple. They put swine on the altar.
Every day.
And we got it back. And we drove out the enemy. And we reclaimed our religious practice to circumcise our sons and to study Torah. And then we wanted to light the candelabra. We didn't have enough oil. The oil lasted for 8 days. Come on, rank it. Seriously. We're so trained about the oil, about the lights, that maybe we're not seeing things clearly. Are you telling me that the fact that they wanted to light the candelabra but couldn't find enough oil and then it lasted for 8 days outweighs and outshines, all puns intended, the very notion of the military victory and reclaiming the temple in the first place? Come on.
That's what kids learn. That's what they remember.
Which part?
The candle. The
oil
part.
The oil part. Mm-hmm. Because that's all we do. Right. That's all we commemorate. The question is why. There's a few other questions. If you look back at the Talmud, text 1, the Talmud says, third paragraph there, when the Greeks entered the sanctuary, what did they do?
Contaminated all the oil.
It doesn't say anything else other than they contaminated all the oils. The Talmud says, what did the Greeks do? They went in and contaminated the oils. So now, put yourself in the toga of a Greek for a moment. Togas? They wore togas, or those the Romans? The Romans?
I don't know, kind of cold, though.
What were those things?
Laurel.
Huh? What are they called?
Laurel.
Laurel?
Yeah. The leaves?
Like hardy? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like laurel? Okay. Put yourself in a Greek laurel for a moment. Right? Think Greek. Think Greek yogurt and Greek salad for a moment. But listen. Imagine. You're going into the Jewish temple. Right? You're going into the temple, to the most spiritual place for the Jews. And you're ransacking it. Right? You're making it hectic. You're taking it over. You're putting in the pig instead of the other sacrifices. That's what they did. When the Greeks entered the sanctuary, they went and defiled all the oils, but they had nothing else to do but look for the oil. And what does it mean they defiled the oils? They didn't spill out the oil. They didn't like drink the oil. They didn't use it to cook some Greek thing, some stir fry. I don't know if that was a thing back then, but work with me.
They broke the seal.
They just broke the seal. Okay. There was special oil that was made for the menorah. Special oil, like first press, a whole cool thing. Whatever. Like, you know, cold brew coffee. Nothing like that. Whatever. So it was first pressed olive oil, and it had a special wax seal. And what did the Greeks do? They defiled it. What does that mean, they defiled it? They broke the seals. It's like, imagine, you know, those tamper things on medication, on, like a bottle of Tylenol. So it's got that, like, the plastic thing with the writing. It says, don't use if seal is broken. And then I'm like, I can never use it again the second time.
Joke. It bothers me when I go to the kosher deli and I get food and they forget to seal it.
They put that thing. Well, they really should do that.
It really bothers me.
I feel like we've just... This could go viral because we're on Facebook. We're coming after you. Kidding. So getting back to this thing. So what do they do? So imagine, you have the thing of Tylenol, and all you do, you don't even open it up. All you do is just crack that seal on the thing. So now it's not sealed anymore. That's what they did? Were they that bored that they just went around breaking seals? Like, who does that? I know the Greeks, but why? Why did they do that? What was the thought process? So number one, we have questions. I have another question or two to ask. So number one, why do we commemorate just the oil? Number two, why did the Greeks focus on the oil? Why were they tampering with the oil in the first place? Number three, why did the Jews spend so much effort? Expend so much effort in finding the pure oil. Do you know that there's a halacha, there's a Jewish law that says that in times of crisis, or crises plural, right, when things are no good, you can use impure oil. It's not the end of the world. So what was this whole business of? They were searching, they finally found it, but then it wasn't enough, so they lit it, it was a miracle, they were so happy. What's the big deal? Just light regular oil. And even if they didn't light the menorah, they hadn't lit it in a while, they didn't have the temple for a long time. So what's another 8 days amongst friends? By the way, I'm not suggesting that they shouldn't have lit it, but I'm saying, like, how did it become such a big deal? So again, I think, I don't know how many questions we've had, but let's recount them. Number one, why do we commemorate what seems to be a very secondary element of the story? The main story is we got back to the temple. It's a big deal. We got back to the Beis HaMikdash. That's the big deal. It's like, that's totally glossed over. And the main thing is that when they found the oil, it was not enough. How did that become so big? Why did the Greeks intentionally seek to defile the oil in the first place? And why did the Jews spend so much effort to find that oil and then to light it? So take a look at text number six. These are not my questions. Take a look at text number six. Here we have the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the Friedrich Rebbe, who expresses the second question that I asked. Sarah, please read. By the way, this is a talk that he gave, from a discourse from 5701, which is 1941. Take it away.
The entire matter is puzzling. When the Greek army was victorious in their military campaign, entered the sanctuary, They displayed their victory by contaminating the oil in the sanctuary. Now in the temple, there were gold and silver vessels, and the more common behavior of a victorious army would be to despoil and collect gold, silver, and precious stones. Yet we do not find mention of the Greeks engaging in any of this, only that they contaminated the oil in the temple. Why?
Who does that? It's like, you've just conquered the temple. What are you going to do next? We're going to defile the oils. Like, really? That's it?
What about the gold?
Gold. Who needs gold? The oils. We're going to crack those seals. What's going on? All right. In order to understand this, we need to understand what is the deeper significance of oil. So I'll give you the framework for what we're going to do. We ask questions about the core question we asked is, why does oil play such a prominent role in both the celebration, in the antagonization of the Jews, and in the dedication of the Jews after the rededication of the Jews of the temple? Why does the oil play such a big role? And to explain this, we're going to proceed in this lesson to explore the deeper significance of oil. What is the Kabbalistic meaning of oil? Why is oil therefore so important in the Hanukkah story, and why is oil important in our lives?
Did we have a menorah though?
It seems like they did.
The original one.
I don't know if it was the original. I don't think it was the original one.
Because I often wonder what they poured it into what.
I believe that I've read in the past, not this year, but in the past, I think I've read that they lit a wooden menorah because the golden one was... The previous Rebbe is not saying that they didn't go after the gold and silver. I don't think he's saying that. What I think he's saying is, how come it doesn't mention it? Now, you could say it's only mentioning the in context that we need to understand. Like, it's if we found the oil, you need to mention that the oil was tampered with in the first place, and that's why they had to look for it, and they only found one cruse, and that's part of the thing. But again, it still seems like very focused on oil. Okay. So what's going on? So in order to understand what is the deeper meaning of oil, let's look at some deeper meanings of other liquids in Jewish thought. So we're gonna learn about water, milk, and wine, and then oil. So water, milk, wine, and oil. You ready? Let's start with water. Mike, please bring us some water.
Rabbi Hanina Bar Idi said, why are matters of Torah like the water, as it is written, everyone who thirsts come from water. This verse teaches us just as water leaves a high place and flows to a low place, so too Torah matters are retained only by one whose spirit is lowly, that is, a humble person.
So there's a verse that says, everyone who thirsts, come for water, and that's a euphemism for Torah. Whoever's thirsty for meaning, significance, etc., should come for the water that is Torah. Why is Torah compared to water? So the Talmud explains in Tractate Tainit that just like water always flows downward, so too Torah is only found in someone who's humble. Someone who's arrogant does not retain Torah. If someone studies Torah and they're arrogant, they don't have Torah, they have hot air, they have themselves. They don't have Torah. Torah is found by someone who is, Torah is retained only by somebody whose spirit is humbled, again, like water. Water never sits still. There's never been a case, unless it's frozen, but there's never been a case where you poke a hole in the cup and the water says, you know what? It's nice in the cup. It's fine. I don't need to go anywhere. It's fine. I'm comfortable. I'm okay. It's okay. You can have someone else, you know, someone else can do that, but I'll stay right where I am. Water is always seeking the lowest point. And if another low point opens up, it's going down there. So Torah is retained by someone who, again, has not in a negative way, a low spirit, but again, a humble spirit. Good. Here's how the Alter Rebbe explains it in Tanya. He takes this concept of water descending and gives another twist on it, why it's compared to Torah, text number 8. Steve, please.
Torah compared to milk and honey?
Yeah, also. Israel is the land of milk and honey.
Right.
Is Torah compared to milk and honey?
Yeah.
Probably, somewhere. Okay. Sounds familiar. I can't put my finger on it.
Something around Shavuot.
Yeah, the Torah's sweet. Yeah.
Okay.
Something. Okay, text number 8. Here's what the Alter Rebbe says. Steve.
The Torah has thus been compared to water, for just as water descends from a higher level to a lower level, so is Torah descended from a place of glory, which is God's will and wisdom, and Torah is one and the same with God, whom no thought can apprehend at all. From there, the Torah has journeyed in a descent through hidden stages, stage after stage, and the histol shalut chain of the worlds until it integrated into material matters and things of this corporeal world, which comprise nearly all of the Torah's commandments and their laws.
So the Alter Rebbe says something else, that not just the Torah is found and retained in someone who is humble, who is low, but Torah itself, like water, has descended. Torah starts off as divine wisdom, divine will, and it goes down through the successive stages of reality until it becomes concretized and formulated in language and ideas and concepts and cases that are very physical. In fact, it says elsewhere in Chassidic philosophy that look at Torah. Torah entertains false claims. Torah talks about what happens if a litigant is lying. Can you imagine God's will wrapping itself around a lie? Think about it. We don't think about this. It's an interesting angle to think about. Okay? Torah is God's will and God's wisdom. Imagine God's wisdom is telling us what to do in a case of a lie. Two witnesses come and they testify that so-and-so committed a crime. And these two witnesses made up the story, fabricate the story. Jewish law says that when two witnesses conspire to falsely convict someone and they're caught, you do to them what they wanted to do to the other guy. So whatever punishment, whatever consequence, I should mention we have a course on Jewish criminology coming up in February called Crime and Consequence. Stay tuned for more details. Brochures at the front door when you leave. We'll show them up. They just arrived today. There's always a commercial. There's always a commercial. Okay, good. So what's the point? The point is you do to the witnesses what they wanted to do to the other guy, to the actual guiltless party. The fellow who wasn't guilty that they were trying to railroad, you do to them what they wanted to do. These are called Edim Zomimim. That's what it's called. Edim Zomimim. These are false witnesses that conspire to convict someone. So it's a capital case. You might actually put them to death for false testimony, even though they didn't kill anybody. But through their testimony, they would have killed somebody. So you do to them what they... That's, of course, the most extreme case, etc. What's the point? The point is Torah tells us what to do in a case where witnesses are making up a story. God's mind, God's wisdom, and God's will is wrapping itself around a conspiracy? God's pure wisdom is involved in human conspiracy? How low does that go? God's pure, perfect, infinite wisdom wrapping itself around human conspiracies? That's very low. Torah is compared to water. Just like water goes down, 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 God's wisdom and will starts off in the purest of places, down, 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 until it wraps itself in this world and our reality. That's how the Alter Rebbe explains the correlation between water and Torah. The point here is, water is compared to Torah. What about milk and wine? I'm glad you asked. Text number 9 for milk and wine. Figured I would rhyme with that one. And please read text number 9, tractate Tainit once again.
And Rabbi Oshaya said, why are matters of Torah likened to these three liquids, to water, wine, and milk? As it is written with regard to water, ho, everyone who thirsts, come for water. And it is written in the same verse, come, buy and eat, you come, buy wine and milk without money. Without price.
So there's a juxtaposition there that the same verse that compared water to Torah also talks about wine and milk. So now we're throwing all three in the same category. So now we know about water being compared to Torah. But how do milk and wine also compare to Torah? So here we go.
This verse comes to tell you just as these three liquids can be retained only in the least of vessels, clay pots, but not vessels of silver and gold, as they will spoil, so too matters of Torah are retained only by one whose spirit is lowly.
See, thank you. There are different types of vessels. How wise, how cool is the Talmud, right? It just throws out these lines. Love it. So the Talmud says, look, there are different types of vessels. Earthenware vessels, clay vessels, right? And then you have metal vessels like silver and gold. And the Talmud says there are certain things that spoil. The fancier the vessel, the worse it is. So if you put wine in silver in a silver vessel, I don't know, I've never tried it. I'm not such a wine connoisseur. But the Talmud says it's going to spoil. It's going to get...
metallic taste?
Yeah. Metallica. No, it's going to get... it's going to get, I would say, oxidized, but that may not even be a thing.
Huh? So we bought Jacob Rosenthal, the Kiddush cups and candle, Shabbos candles, sticks. And they're silver and gold with gold plate.
But I think it means storing it for a long amount of time, not just for the... Because that's pretty quick. But I think if you leave it, you don't store wine in a metal vat. Right. No, you don't store... You don't keep milk in a metal vat. Certainly not at room temperature for a while. I'm kidding. This is what the Talmud says. It stays better in the clay, in the earthenware vessel, in the clay vessel, and not in the silver and gold. The point is that Torah, like these liquids, Torah is retained precisely in a simple vessel. Not someone who's ostentatious, not someone who's haughty, not someone who's arrogant, someone who's humble spirit, that person can retain Torah. Fine, so now we have water and milk and wine all likened to Torah, and the message is, the common message is, humility, being humble. Good. However, once we have this idea that water equals Torah, and milk equals Torah, and wine equals Torah, now we can differentiate between some of these comparisons. And we can say the following. And this is what Jewish mysticism teaches. There's water as Torah, and there's wine as Torah, and they are two different dimensions of Torah. Milk we'll have to leave for another class. Yeah. Milk is not going to happen tonight. So let's talk about water and wine. So water, what does water taste like?
Water.
It's not so fancy. Simple, huh?
Depends if you're thirsty.
Right, exactly. Water is very simple. Water is basic. But water, with all of its tastelessness, is the most life-giving and thirst-quenching liquid that we have. Correct? Mm-hmm. Okay. What about wine? Is it simple or sophisticated?
Complex.
It's complex.
It is.
Some people call it sophisticated. Mike, you're not calling it sophisticated?
No, I said very
sophisticated. Very sophisticated. Right. Super sophisticated. Right. So you have wine versus water. Water is simple, but it's essential. And what is wine? Wine is complex, but non-essential. You don't need wine to live, right? I mean, look, wine is a good plus. After you have basic water, then you have your wine. But it's not a staple. It's not existence itself. So in the mystical tradition, each of these liquids, water and wine, correspond to a different dimension of Torah. Water corresponds to what we would call the revealed dimensions of Torah. And wine corresponds to the secrets of Torah. So the basic, the revealed parts of Torah are Jewish law, Jewish practice. But you need to know, basically, when I say essentially, I mean the core ideas that you need to know to live a Jewish life. Yeah, what's kosher? What's Shabbat? What's the holiday? What's a circumcision? What's a bar mitzvah? Basic stuff. That's water. That's the water of Judaism. That's the water of Torah. What's the wine of Torah? Oh, sophistication. Depth, secrets, Kabbalah, Sod, right? All these wonderful secrets of the Torah, all the secrets that get us spiritually high, like wine, that might get us, might lift us up, lift our spirits up a little bit higher. So the secrets of Torah lift us up. So there's a revealed Torah and the secrets of Torah. Revealed Torah is?
Wine.
Water. Secrets of Torah is? The wine. Let's take a look at text number 10. Dan?
It is a popular notion that Torah is associated with water and wine. The revealed plane of Torah is called water, and the wine of Torah gladdens the heart.
I.e. gladdens the heart. In other words, it lifts us up because it reflects the secrets of Torah. Text 11, the Talmud gives us gematria, gives us numerology. Tim, perfect timing for you, my numerology buddy. All right, take a look.
Wine was hidden with 70 letters. The gematria of Yayin is 70. Similarly, the secret was given with 70 letters. The gematria of Sod is 70. When wine enters the body, secrets emerge.
So the Talmud says, yeah, the numerology of Yayin, Yud Yud Nun, 10, 10, 50 is, 10 plus 10 plus 50 is 70. Sod, which is secret in Hebrew, Samach Vav Dalet, Samach is 60, Vav is 6, and Dalet is 4. 66 plus 4 is 70. So there's a numerical equivalency between wine and secrets. So the Talmud says, Nichnas Yayin Yatzah Sod. You put the wine in, the secrets come out. That's the way it works. Drink some wine. The next thing you know, I could have been president. All these deep secrets that you thought you'd never share come out after a few l'chaims. So what's the point? The point, huh?
In vino veritas. What is that's it? The Latin.
In wine. Uh-huh. Truth in wine.
Oh, guess what? They got it from the Talmud. The Talmud talks about though in the realm of secrets. But how does Kabbalah understand it? When you drink the wine of Torah, that's where you find the secrets. That's where you discover the secrets. It's the secret, the mystical dimension of Torah. But all of this, as you've noticed, whether we're talking about water or milk, which we very much glossed over, or wine, what didn't we talk about yet?
Oil.
Oil was the point of the class. How did we miss that? So here's what we got. Hasidic philosophy tells us that notwithstanding how deep the wine of Torah is, the oil of Torah is even deeper. You see, there are four dimensions of Torah study. Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. The simple, the allegorical, the homiletical, and I know we don't know what these words mean, but don't worry, we'll go for it. And then the Sod is the mystical, the Kabbalah. So you have four dimensions of Torah study, and you have wonderful insights. You can read a verse and understand it on a simple level. You can understand the hints in the text. You can understand the drush, like the life lessons that you can draw from it. And then you can understand the Kabbalah, the mystical secrets that are contained in that verse. But there's a fifth dimension. And the fifth dimension is Chassidut, or Chassidus, like we would say in Eastern Europe. Ashkenazis would say, right? Chassidus. Hasidic philosophy, that's the oil. What is significant about oil? Oil does two things, and we have texts that speak to this. Oil has a very interesting dualistic nature. Oil does opposites. I don't think anyone here knows this, but I moonlight as I have another job that I moonlight as. And I know you're all wondering, what in the world is he talking about? On occasion, every few months or so, I put on a lab coat and I put on crazy hair and I go to our preschool and I am the mad scientist and I do experiments, science experiments with our preschool kids. Each of them usually centered around the holiday with a theme related to the holiday. So for Hanukkah, I came in and we did this incredible experiment called Trading Places, where I fill up a glass jar, like a skinny vase. I fill up one with oil, and I do one with water with food coloring. So like a whole thing filled up the top with oil and water. And I ask the children, do you think they can switch places? They're like, no, how could it? Of course not. And I say, watch. And I take a playing card. And I cover the one with the oil, with the water, and I flip it over on top of the other one, and then I pull out the card. And what happens? The water in the top goes to the bottom, and the oil in the bottom goes to the top. And I ask the kids, did they switch places? Yeah. I said, you want to see it again? Flip it over again, carefully. And again, they switch places. Why am I telling you this? Number one, because I feel like you should know that I'm the mad scientist. But also, after all these years, finally someone should know. No. But also, number two, it's because oil, we all know this, oil does not mingle. Oil is separate. Oil is distinct. Oil is different. Other liquids. Oh, it's a fabring and they mix in. Yeah, you put food coloring. Yeah, I'll be blue today. You put, oh, I'll be purple. No problem. It's a whole mixture. Oil, nope. I'm sorry. I don't hang out with these people. I don't know you. I don't hang out in these circles. I'm over there off to the side. Oil is separate. Have you ever had an oil stain in your clothes? Yeah? What happened? Could you get it out?
No. Yes.
But it's not so easy. Why? Because you know what oil does when it hits clothing or fabric? What happens? It goes all the way in. It's in the language of Jewish law. It's mefafea. It saturates and it permeates. So now think about it. On the one hand, oil separates. On the other hand, oil saturates. So which one is it? Is it a separatist or a mingler, the ultimate mingler? What's the answer? Of course, yes. Does both. It's the magic of oil, or whatever, the curse of oil, right? Oil both separates when it hits liquid, but saturates when it hits a solid. That's the nature of oil. So Kabbalah teaches, well, Chassidus teaches, Chassidic philosophy teaches, that oil is symbolic. Deeper than Kabbalah is Chassidic philosophy, Chassidus. Why? It's not just another layer of Torah scholarship. It's the fifth dimension, which we call the quintessence. It's the quint, it's the fifth level that is the essence. It's not just, thank you. Yeah, thanks. It's not just, they seem to be following us for every class. Right, last night also they were. Listen, got to keep the place clean somehow. It's the quintessence, which means as follows. It's not just another layer. It's the essence layer of the Torah, which means as the Rebbe develops in his treatise that's called Kuntres Inyana Shel Torah HaChassidus, which is in the English, the book is entitled On the Essence of Chassidus, which we studied at Kabbalah and Coffee over the course of probably a year and a half or so. What the Rebbe develops there is the idea that Chassidus is not just one of the layers of Torah, but it actually is the life and the essence of all of the layers of Torah. So it explains Pshat, the simple layer. It illuminates the simple. And it illuminates the Remez, the hint. And it illuminates the Drush. And it illuminates the Kabbalah. Why? Because it's the core essence that is Mefafeya. It saturates all, every single level. It's so much deeper. But it's also the essence that drives, that powers, that illuminates all of the others. So now let's translate into human terms, because each of us possesses a soul. And our souls are also comprised of five dimensions. In Kabbalah, by the way, I'm now paraphrasing all of the texts. So the remaining texts. The five dimensions of the soul are Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, and Yechida. In English, there's no reason to translate it because they all could be translated as soul or spirit. So nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida. In Kabbalah classes, we speak about this a lot, but here's the summary. The fifth dimension, the deepest dimension, yechida, is understood not just to be the deepest, but the essence that in fact permeates and speaks to all of the other dimensions. But what distinguishes the Yechida from the other dimensions, not only is it their core, but, and here's the relevant point for us and answering all of the Hanukkah-related questions that we asked before, Yechida, the quintessence, the fifth and an essence dimension of the soul, the Yechida level is the part of us that is connected with God, not because we understand, and not because we know, and not because we feel, and not even because we believe. No, it's because it's who we are. You don't know yourself not know.
No, you don't.
You're not, well, I didn't mean that. You're not aware of yourself. You're not in yourself because you know or you feel or you believe. It's because that's who you are. I am who I am because that's who I am. The fifth dimension of the soul binds us to God, not through logic, not through emotion, not through action, not through even faith or belief. But the fifth dimension of the soul binds us to God because that is our DNA. The fifth part of the soul is the part that is a piece of God itself. So it's one with God. We are one with God on our yechida level because we're one with God, not for any other side reason that points us to God, but because that's who we are essentially. That's what yechida is. But like I said, yechida can express itself on every other level, which means that you and I can act and do a mitzvah infused by that reality of I am a piece of God. Or we can understand something about God infused by that core reality of I am internally connected with God in this way that is essential. Here's the point. The Greeks came in, and what is the first thing they did? The way it's told to us in the narrative, in Tractate Shabbat in the Talmud, what's the first thing they did? When the Greeks came into the sanctuary, timu kolashmanim shebehechol. What did they do? They defiled all of the
oil.
They attempted to destroy that core connection that we have with God. They were trying to tamper with the yechida, the core level. They said, if you want to have an intellectual relationship with God, that we can understand. You want to have an emotional relationship with God, that we also are philosophers, and we also came to understand God through our mind or through our heart or through action that we get. But you tell me that you're a piece of God that transcends all logical explanations, any rational, any conventional method. You are just simply a piece of God, no questions asked, no debates, and that's it. At the core, they couldn't handle that. They couldn't tolerate this type of intensely, it's not only super rational, but it's this quintessential connection that Jews believe in, that Jews live by. They couldn't tolerate that, and they try to break that from the Jews. They said, in fact, some sources tell us that they weren't even opposed to us studying Torah. They just didn't want us to study Torah because it was our identity. They said, study Torah because it's a beautiful book of wisdom. Have faith. They said, we'll even be okay if you do a mitzvah that is super rational because you know that you can't know everything, so you can take a leap of faith, a logical leap of faith. Are you with me? You know, a human being can realize that we don't know everything and that some things are good for us even though we don't understand it. And so I'll suspend my logic and do something because I know that I can't know everything. Guess what? Who ratified that action? The mind. The mind said it's a good idea to do things that you don't always understand because I can't understand everything. So who signed off on it? The mind. Good. So the Greeks also wanted us to do super rational things because our mind said okay. But this core idea of I'm a Jew and that's who I am and this is what I'll do to my dying day, even though you tell me it's crazy, it's meshuggah, whatever, it doesn't matter. This is who I am. It's my yechida expressing itself, the pintaliyid, the core Jewish spark inside of me. That's what they couldn't handle. And
they
so they
must have known about it. They knew.
Yeah, they knew. They knew. I mean, you know, you look at the world and you say, why anti-Semitism? Like, what do we do wrong? Like, why? And it's back, right? Just look around. Just look around. In America.
Everywhere.
United States. I mean, it's been back for a while in other places, but welcome to the new reality. I mean, hopefully not the new reality, but it's, yeah. Anyway, and you wonder, like, what? So what is it? They knew. They knew. They knew what we believe in. They knew who we are. They know what we have inside. They knew about the Yechida. Whether they can name it or not, they knew it. And they were smart. They were very smart. The Greeks were very smart. And so what did they do? They went right after the oil. And when the Jews were victorious, what did they reclaim? What's the first thing they went after to fix, to reclaim? The oil. And they found one small cruse. And that was enough. One connection that still remains because the connection can never be broken. That's the message. The message is, no matter how much a person thinks that life can take away, diminish, God forbid, destroy that inner connection that we have with God, the Yechida never drowns. The Yechida is never incinerated. The Yechida is never melted. It can never go away. The Yechida is always there. That cruise of oil, that Yechida, that core, that quintessence of the soul, that innate connection that we have with God is always there, no matter what it looks like on the surface. The outside of the temple can be ransacked. The inside of the temple can be ransacked. All of the other oils can be compromised. But there's always a connection that remains. So now we understand why it is that the Greeks went after the oil. Why it is that the Jews spent so much time in the oil. And now we understand why. In our practice and observance of Hanukkah, went too long. All that we do is about the oil. About lighting the lights. Because that's what this holiday is about. This holiday is simply about, it's simply about affirming who we are at our core. And not letting anyone ever tell us that we don't have that connection. And so in our own lives, as we celebrate Hanukkah, let us remember the story of the oil. The story of the oil is the story of a connection that runs deeper than water, runs deeper than milk, runs deeper than wine. It's a connection that is as thick as oil and as constant as the Hanukkah flames that have been kindling our lives for the last 2,300 years. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies. Happy Hanukkah.